The one thing that I want to reiterate is really the right like to speak. Again, that simple principle of that if you are stuck, and we are often stuck, we all experience writer's block at certain points. If you're stuck, think about how you'd say it in a conversation. Give yourself that 30-second test. Somebody puts you on the spot. What's the most important point? And really go through that. And if you think about how you could write it, then you could all how you say it, you can write. What I say is if you could say it well, then you could write it well.
Welcome to the Ideas on Stage podcast, your regular insight into leadership communication.
Hey Jack, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Andrea. It's a pleasure to be here.
The pleasure is mine, Jack. And I think we got in touch. We got to know each other. If I'm not wrong, Jack, that was thanks to Todd Churches, I guess a friend in common who's also teaching at New York University. And then we got in touch on LinkedIn. You were very kind to pick up my book and read it and made it available to your students. So thank you again for that. And then
Yes.
I've done something. I couldn't do the same because I'm not teaching at university, but I read your book, which I have here, 10 Steps to Successful Business Writing. And Jack, you made it difficult for me today because I have to say, now, in preparation for this conversation, I was thinking about what to ask and what topics to explore. And reading your book, there's so much we can talk about, and I don't know where to start. Your book includes so many practical ideas, examples, before, after, good and bad examples that we can apply immediately in our own business writing. So it's great. Thank you very much. It's not easy for me. I've got so many ideas I'd like to cover. Let's see how much time we've got today. And let's get started with I'd love to learn to hear your thoughts on these, Jack, because everybody's talking about artificial intelligence at the moment. So what are your thoughts? Why do you think, if you do, and I guess you do, why do you think we should care about good writing in an age where we've got artificial intelligence who potentially could do a little bit of that for us?
Well, AI is a great tool. I've used it myself, and it's going to be becoming more and more prevalent. The AI that we know today is not going to look anything like this in 2 years. Can you imagine what it's going to be like in 2 years and 5 years? As people who write, we need to learn how to embrace AI, but also to be able to recognize its limits. So when we're writing, so often we are competing for attention. We're sending an email, we're sending a new business proposal. So we have to really key in on, in a lot of cases, what the reader wants to hear. And AI can give us a good framework for doing that. But for us to really make a connection, to really write effectively, we have to be able to use our own instincts, our own abilities, from our own knowledge of the reader, the subject matter. And again, you can use AI in a lot of different ways. For example, you can use AI to generate ideas. Hey, I need ideas on this. Please give me some ideas. You could also use AI, which I have used before. Here are some of my ideas. Here are my drafts of this. Here are my ideas for a lesson for my class based on all this information. What do you think? So it really can be a useful tool, but we have to know its limits.
Yeah. And Jack, I see exactly the same thing in our field, which is, as you know, public speaking, presenting, oral communication. And what I use AI every day for myself, with our clients. I agree with you. It's a very powerful tool. But what's even more powerful is combining AI with some fundamental principles of communication or public speaking or writing in your case. And then that combination becomes really powerful, because otherwise, if we just ask ChatGPT, for example, write this for me, then often the output is not exactly something that we can use, unless the initial prompt, so that's what makes a difference, yeah, is very good. But then giving a very good prompt, you can only do that if you have some form, if you have knowledge of some fundamental yeah principles of, in this case, good, effective writing. In your experience, Jack, what are some of the main challenges that a lot of people face when trying to write more effectively?
Well, they overthink. They overthink and they overwrite. One of the biggest challenges is that a lot of people have this, even though we know that we should be concise when we write, in a lot of people, there's a subconscious feeling, more is better, more is better. It may have been because how we learned how to write way back when we were giving assignments. So it has to be at least 500 words, at least 1,000 words. And even though we are now older, no matter how many years experience we have, we know that we should be concise. There's still the subconscious feeling that we need to give the background and we need to talk about this, when the reader wants you to get to the point as soon as possible. So we have to really tell ourselves, we really have to train ourselves to say, no, 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 I don't need all that. I need to start, in most cases, I need to start with the bottom line. I have an analogy. Anyone who plays golf, right? One of the most fundamental things in golf is you have to keep your head down. Very simple. It's just keep your head down. How easy is that? But yet most beginner and novice golfers can't do that on a consistent basis. So it's really something we know we need to do, but some people, for whatever reason, have trouble doing it.
It's exactly, again, Jack, the same thing we see either with our clients or with, let's say, with our network. And often, at least in our space, Jack, the reason why that happens is because often we know so much about our subject. We are also so close to it. We are passionate about it that we think that everything is important. And so we think yeah that we need to communicate everything. Isn't that true? And we see that when it comes to oral presentations, you say when it comes to business writing. Yeah. And you mentioned something interesting. You said often what we need to do in order to be more concise and clear, which, by the way, is one of the 10 steps that you talk about in the book, is we need to start with the bottom line. Now, some time ago on this podcast, I interviewed Emma Ledden. Emma is the author of the presentation book. She's also a public speaking coach. And she talks about the same thing from the perspective of giving presentations. She says, lead with your strongest point. And she says that what we can do is, one simple thing we can do to improve most presentations is to take the last slide, because many presentations give a lot of context, background, context. And then at the end, oh, by the way, in summary, the key takeaway for you is this. So she says, if you just take the last slide and you move it, that becomes the first one, then you would massively improve most presentations. And it sounds like that this idea, leading with your strongest point or starting with the bottom line, is also a useful piece of advice from a writing perspective. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. You always have to think about, well, what does the reader want? The reader does not want a lot of background and context. They want you to tell them what is going on. One of the techniques that I teach, I call it fast context. A lot of cases, you you do need to give context before you say, well, I recommend these steps for our company. Well, why are you recommending it? But the context shouldn't be paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. You should be able to get that context in within one sentence in most cases. Give the context quickly, then get out of it, and then start talking about what you need to talk about. The other thing about the bottom line is the high level is give the high level first. It's like an executive summary of a proposal. I remember years ago when proposals were a lot longer. I used to work for a company and write all this time on a 10, 15 page proposal. Wonder, did they read it? That's why the executive summary up front is important, because they don't read the rest of it. They read the beginning. And then what you can do is you can always say, here's the bottom line. Below, there are more details and more background. And you give people a choice, because some people are more detail-oriented than others. Some people want to read all the details. Some people don't. Give them a choice. And maybe in a lot of cases you say, take a look at the attached spreadsheet or document if you'd like more information about the subject. People love the fact that you give them a choice. I was trained as a journalist. I was a journalist the first 5 years of my profession. That's what journalists do. Lead newspaper leads, the first paragraph is the bottom line, and then they give more and more and more, but you stop whenever you feel like stopping.
I'm working with a client at the moment, Jack. He worked for 30 years as a journalist. Some of those years with the New York Times, and he's talking about the same things, and now he's preparing for a TEDx style talk. So that's why we're working together. And just now you mentioned something. You said a couple of times, you mentioned the reader. So we need to know what's in it for the reader. And you do talk about it in one of the other steps in your book. So there's one which is persuade readers to take your desired action, which sometimes or often or always is what we want. The objective often is for the audience, I say in my space, in your space, the reader to do something. And to do that, one of the things that you suggest is to address the reader's what's in it for me, what's in it for me from the reader's perspective. And I think, Jack, that this is one of the most important principles in communication in general, whether that's public speaking or writing. For me, if I had to pick one idea, one principle, I would choose this one. The idea of relating what we say or what we write to what's in it for me from the readers, from the audience's perspective. What are your thoughts? Tell me more from your perspective, Jack.
Well, first of all, I agree. It's a very important principle. To my NYU students, I teach business communication, graduate students. This is a principle I emphasize throughout the semester because they have to do written proposals and oral proposals. It's a very simple principle, what's in it for me. But too many people don't follow it. For example, if you need to get information from a client who hasn't given it to you, and they should have, what you don't want to do is I say, I need this, I need that, I need that. What you need to do is say, hey, you need to provide this to you so I can provide you the best service, so you can meet your deadline, so you could achieve the results you want. Just turn it around. It's not, a lot of cases, the transforming of a WIFM is really a few simple word changes, really make it feel that it's what you want. And in a lot of cases, the WIFM, there are two different WIFMs sometimes. One WIFM is the individual person. The other WIFM could be the company. For example, if you are a manager and you're writing to your supervisor, senior executive, One of the senior executives with IMS is to say have more productivity for the division. The other with them may be, hey, you could free up your time, right? So you really have to be conscious in some cases of the person's individual with them and the division or the company's with them.
You said that sometimes it's not always about just about maybe transforming your message. It's about maybe changing. It could be a few words or it could be a sentence to make it about them. And again, this is the key to great communication. Again, whether it's oral or written, the key to great presenting, for example, Jack, is to always talk to your audience about them, even when you're talking about you, like your ideas, your product, your service. You gave an example. You made me think of another example that again Emma Leden gave me in that conversation. She said, so for example, you could say we have 148 offices all over the world. So if I say that, what I'm doing is I'm talking at you about me. But I could make it about you. I could talk to you about you, even if I'm talking about me. So I could say, we have 148 offices all over the world so that you can get access to a customer support team wherever you are, for example.
Yes,
Yeah, yeah.
yes. Well, I remember your book, Make the Audience the Hero. And I tell that to my students that because your book is required reading for all my students ever since I got a hold of your book back this past summer. So thank you for that. Yeah, I believe in you need to lead with that. So if you're trying, for example, to get information from a client that hasn't given it to you, you've asked once before about information, and you need to submit something to a client on their behalf, you may want to say, lead off the email by saying, to ensure that you get this proposal out in time and achieve the best possible results, please give me this information. So you immediately lead with the person's with them. Get them in tune right away with what's important to them, and then they're more likely to give you what you need.
Leading with that, and because you mentioned emails, Jack, you made me think of a very practical tip that you included in your book, which I started using since I read your book. I was not doing that before. And it's about emails. And it's about using, you say, explicit action generating subject lines
Yes.
in your emails. For those who are not familiar with this, can you tell us more?
Sure. When we send emails, in most cases, we are competing for people's attention. We are competing against all these other emails. And of course, we want our emails open sooner or opened at all. How do people choose which emails are going to open? Well, certainly if it's from their boss or senior executive or a client, they're going to open them regardless. But otherwise, whether they're going to open them, how soon they're going to open them, often depends on the subject line. So make your subject lines explicit. Yeah, there's a lot of strategies making your subject give the subject line intrigue, like, hey, it all ends March 1st. You don't know what it is, you open the email for intrigue. That's one strategy. That's fine. But I believe you want to make your subject lines explicit. If you need an agenda, you need somebody's help on an agenda, and you need it by March 1st, say, what? Agenda comments by March 1st. Put that in the subject line. Or if you have an idea that can increase sales, say, new strategy can boost sales 15%. Put that in the subject line. It's in a lot of cases, it's the WIFM that we just talked about, the what's in it for me, start persuading in the subject line. And you have so little time to capture somebody's attention. If it's a persuasive message, start persuading the subject line. Give them, sometimes it's a real art to put a lot of information in the subject line because they shouldn't be too long. But whatever you can to intrigue the person, and again, show them that you are in tune with what they're thinking about.
You said they shouldn't be too long. Just out of curiosity, Jack, do you have any recommendations in terms of how long maximum or how short a subject line should be?
In most cases, I would try to keep it to, say, 6 to 7 words.
Yeah, good. I tend to do six. I found I got the same piece of advice from a great book, which is titled, I don't know whether you know it, Jack, Smart Brevity. Do you know the book?
Yes, I do. I have the book.
Yeah. And they also talk about 6 words in the subject lines. Okay, good. And now you've already shared a few practical tips, which is great. You mentioned earlier that some of these things, intuitively, we know them, but we don't, for some reason, we don't put them into practice. In your experience, are there any reasons for that, or are there any bad habits or ineffective habits when it comes to day-to-day writing that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, well, what you said first is for some reason we don't write effectively, particularly the first shot, which is fine. We always should take time to review. But one of the things that I teach is write like you speak. Some people are very surprised to hear me say that. I've had executives challenge me on that. But very often when I am coaching somebody and I say to the person, I don't understand what you're trying to say in this paragraph. The person says to me, well, Jack, I'm trying to say this, this, and this. So I tell them, okay, well then write this, this, and this. It's amazing when I ask people to explain to me what they're trying to say, how perfectly clear they are out loud, right? Good business writing should be conversational. Conversational does not mean unprofessional. You can be highly professional being conversation and being informal. Most businesses, the writing is a lot more informal than it used to be. So a lot of times when you're stuck on how to say something, think about how you say it out loud. I do. One of the things I talk about in the book and I do with clients is, okay, you don't know how to start. People tell me, I have really a lot of trouble starting. Okay, well, imagine if you got a frantic phone call and somebody says, I need you to tell me in 30 seconds what's going on with this client. What would you say? What would your instincts say? Well, you'd probably get to the point right away because when you don't have a choice, you will be concise. You will get to the point. So it's a very simple technique, but very effective in getting people centered, getting people unstuck, and getting them to say what the most important points are right away.
Again, Jack, I see exactly the same dynamic all the time with our clients as well. Even when it comes to preparing for an oral presentation, for example, when the language we use with friends or even with colleagues tends to be conversational, but then as soon as the dynamic is a little bit more formal, we are giving a presentation, for example, then we change language and we use complex technical language there. And I agree with you. It's not so conversational doesn't mean unprofessional. This is not about dumbing things down. It's not about oversimplifying. It's really about finding and using language that everyone in the audience or among your readers can understand. And simplicity is one of the key steps that, that you talk about. You say that the this perhaps the single most effective quality of good writing is simplicity, right?
Yes, absolutely. And what I do when I have a live workshop, let's say 15, 16 people, as I'm setting up, I bring four children's books with me. And I spread them out around the room. And as people, before we start, hey, you three here, I want you to take a look at that book and pick a line from it. And I do that with, say, three or four of the groups. And maybe about 15 minutes into the workshop, my first principle is tap the power of simplicity. I say, all right, let's hear the lines from the book. And they all read the book. And they have a good time. Everyone's smiling. It's a children's book. Maybe they remember it from their childhood, all that. And then I say, wow, isn't it great to hear something so simple, easy to understand, that's not wordy, right? Say, well, again, I'm not saying we should write business memos by starting See Spot Run or something like that. But still, it's really all about having people understand something as soon as possible. Sometimes there's an instinct with some of us that we want to impress the reader. We want to impress an executive. We want to impress a client. And we want to use these big words. Again, sometimes it's subconscious. But the executive or whoever the reader is, they don't want that. They want simplicity.
And Jack, simple is harder than complex because anyone can use, for example, long, confusing sentences. Anyone can use jargon or technical terms or buzzwords.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a lot of people do. A lot of people, I agree with you, a lot of people use complex language because they think that if they do that, then they sound smarter and more credible. But the opposite is true. I agree with you. What great communicators do is they use simple language. And you said earlier, then of course you should not use kids' language in business memos.
Yeah.
Yes. But for example, in Carmine Gallo's latest book, The Bezos Blueprint, which I recommend for our listeners if they're interested, he also talks about writing there. And he gives an example. He shows that 70% up to or even more than 17% of Jeff Bezos' shareholder letters to during his, I think, 24-year span at Amazon CEO. So we're talking about business letters to Amazon shareholders, talking mm-hmm. about business and strategies, all these kind of things. If you analyze the language there, then in most cases, Jeff Bezos uses language that a 13 to maximum 15-year-old would understand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good practice. What great communicators do is, now I don't know in writing, but in general, in communication, good communicators use language that even a 15-year-old would understand. What are your thoughts, Jack?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you need to do that. It's what you don't want is somebody having to think, what do they mean by this? You don't want to have people misinterpret or even take extra time to figure it out. You want them to figure it out immediately. Now, it's true. In some cases, there are people who write for technical audiences, and there's people, they know the audiences know these terminologies. That's fine. But you also, with the technical writing, you need to be able to, in a lot of cases, even though you might be writing to somebody in the industry, what a lot of people who are technical writers don't do as well as they should is they don't explain the business implications. They get stuck in the technical details, and they spend too much time on the technical details and not explaining the business implications soon enough or clearly enough.
Yeah, perhaps they don't ask themselves the so what question, So what? Why should they care? And again, going back to what you said, of course, what's in it for me? Again, so it depends on the audience. Of course, if you know, if you are 100% sure that your audience knows exactly what you're trying to communicate, that's a different story. But again, I agree, in many cases, that's not the case. And one of the steps in your book is being clear and concise. We started by talking about that. And there is another practical tip there, which is something that I also got from my publisher last year when I published the book, Jack, which is the idea of using fewer words or fewer sentences to explain the same thing. My publisher, my editor, taught me that if there is a, for example, if there is a short word or a long word and both words say the same thing, in most cases, use the short word. Or if you can say one thing and you can say it with, say, with 5 words, if you can say the same thing with 15 words, say it in 5 words. Anything to add? Would you like to share your thoughts on this idea of using fewer words, fewer sentences?
Yeah, I totally agree. It goes back to what Thomas Jefferson, who was the third U.S. president, said more than 200 years ago. One of the greatest skills is never to use 2 words when one will do. And it's true. And the one thing that I want to add about that is some people say, oh, I just struggle. I write too much. Give yourself the freedom to be wordy the first time you write. It's okay. Just let it out. Just like write like you speak. Just say it, write it, and then take a look at it. Then you could say, chop this word, chop that word. Oh, that word's too long. I can use a simpler word. I could use instead of utilize, whatever. But give yourself the freedom the first time around just to write as your thoughts are coming out. Then make sure you reserve the time to review what you've written. That's one of the biggest mistakes people make, is that they have so many emails to write or so many reports to write, particularly with emails. I say to people, okay, let's say you have 3 emails to write in the morning. And we're so anxious, we're so eager to get emails off our desk and sent to somebody. And in people who work, I do a lot of work with people in the public relations and communications field, professional communicators. And they often are very eager to get, they've written something, say a press release or a product report, they want to get it to their supervisor for review. So wait a minute, you have to edit it yourself. You have to make it as perfect for you before you send it out. So if you have a few to do, draft it, but then don't send it. Let it sit. Work on the second one. Let it sit, then come back. It's amazing when people come back to what they've written, how much better they are. They can see, hey, that doesn't work. I didn't really mean to say that. I don't need that many words. When I have my coaching sessions, what I often do is often somebody brings me something they're working on their jobs. That, all right, let's take a look at it. I'll tell you what, you review it, you read it out loud. And before I tell you what I would change, what do you think? And so often they say, oh yeah, I could have said this, but oh yeah, I don't need this. I don't need that. So a lot of it is really changing your habits, reserving the time to review your emails. And that's assuming, I understand some cases people have ridiculously tight deadlines. They have to get an email in 20 minutes. But in most cases, you have more time than that to send an email, or draft a report, or even part of a proposal, whatever you're doing. So you have to reserve that time for editing and proofreading.
It's connected to another thing that my publisher mentioned, which stuck with me. I don't remember who said that, but she told me somebody very famous, Jeff, but I don't remember whom. He said that the first draft of anything is shit. Oh, I think it was Hemingway. Yeah, Hemingway. Hemingway
Okay.
said apparently that the first draft of everything is shit. So the importance of going back to it, editing. And again, another thing I wanted to add is that you said it's amazing what happens when you come back to it. And it happens the same thing, for example, in our situation, Jack, when we, in preparation for a presentation, when we work with a client, one of the first things we do is after we analyze the audience, then we brainstorm effectively to come up with lots of interesting ideas that potentially we can include in the content of the presentation. And what we always do is we do the initial brainstorming session and then we let it sit, we let it there. And then we ask the client, or we do it together, to come back to it, to those ideas, not even on the same day, maybe the day after or a few days after. And because that in the meantime, our brain works and it connects dots, it comes up with fresh ideas, and it's super, super powerful. I agree. Okay. Now, another principle, another step that you cover as part of your 10 steps in your book is writing with style and rhythm, which is about creating a smooth flow of words and sentences. Can you give us some ideas in terms of how we can do that, writing with style and rhythm?
Yeah, well, just like your favorite song has a pleasing rhythm, that's why you listen to it. Words have a rhythm. Even if they're not said out loud, words have a rhythm. Words need to flow. There are certain things you could do, certain easy things you could do to make your words flow, and that is consistent verb tense. You need to kind of check to see there are transition words like all, also, or very simple words, additionally, or and, or but. And there's a myth that some people say, hey, how could you start a sentence with and, or but, or because? Well, you look at any newspaper, they all do it. So if they can do it, we can do it. But anyway, there are certain techniques you can use to make your text flow better. There's consistent verb tense, parallel structure, transition words, are also known as connectors.
There's Jack, there's sorry to cut you off, but there is because you mentioned some techniques. There was one in particular that I captured from their chapter, which I found really interesting, which is you talk about the difference between verbs hidden in nouns and active verbs. So because you mentioned verbs now, can you, for those who are not familiar with this, can you tell us the difference between verbs hidden in nouns and active verbs? And in your book, you talk about the power of using active verbs.
Best way is through an example. We need to perform an analysis of Q4 sales. Okay. It's nothing grammatically wrong with the sentence, but it's weak. Perform an analysis. The word analysis is what we call a hidden verb. What's the verb in analysis? Analyze, right? So you would revise a sentence and say, we need to analyze Q4 sales. Very simple change makes your writing that much stronger.
And by the way, it makes that sentence shorter as well, going back to what we were talking about before.
Absolutely. So always look for when you write, do I have what we call a hidden verb? Analysis, is a noun, but the hidden verb in there is analyze. Now, it doesn't mean you never use the word analysis, but always look for situations where you could use the strong verb. Verbs are the most powerful part of speech in the English language, but most people don't use them as effectively as they could.
And I want to emphasize this again for our listeners. Now, you gave us a very practical example now. And for our listeners, if you are interested in these ideas, if writing is an important part of what you do, check out Jack's book because it's full of examples like this. And Another thing I captured from the same chapter, Jack, is the importance of repetition, which, and there is a parallel there when it comes to public speaking communication. You say that, provided that we do it well, repetition is good in when writing. Is that correct?
Yeah, it can be. It's good to, repetition is good when you need to reemphasize, reiterate points. When you're doing a new business proposal, I tell all my students when they're doing their written proposals, have a section at the end, the closing, where you're reiterating the key points, reiterating the WIFMs to the client. So when done strategically, repetition is good, that it reminds people, it brings people back to what you want to leave them with. You want them to remember.
Hi there. Before we continue with this episode, I just wanted to take a moment to share with you some resources that I believe would be super useful for you. The first one is my book, Confident Presenter. Check it out. You can find it on Amazon. I'm going to include the link in the show notes. It's a book for business owners, leaders, and the teams who want to become more credible, confident, and convincing presenters. To make the most of the book, take the Confident Presenter Scorecard, which is an online tool that allows you to assess your current presentation skills in less than 3 minutes for free. You just need to answer a few questions. The scorecard will give you a score from 0 to 100%. It will tell you what that score means for you, and it will also identify opportunities for improvement. And then the last thing is my web class. I often run free presentation skills web classes where I go through my own process for creating my own presentations and those of our clients. So if you're interested, I'd love to see you there. I'm going to include all the links in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. It means the world to me. Now, let's jump back into the conversation. What I find, Jack, is that if there is, and I'm talking about from my perspective when it comes to public speaking, if there is an important message that you want to get across, if you tell your audience once, then most likely they'll forget it. But if you tell them, say, a couple of times, three times, of course, you don't want to overdo it. But especially what's useful is to, when you're speaking in public, is to tell me the same thing, repeat the key message, but do it in a different way. Use different words, different sentences, because otherwise it can feel boring. Hey, Jay, I'm there. You told me already. But if you use different words, different sentences, repetition is good in communication. And there is another step, which is choosing the right tone. And there are many takeaways I captured from that chapter. But what are your thoughts? Tell us more about the importance of choosing the right tone when writing.
Well, first of all, it's much harder to choose our tone when we write, when we speak. When we speak, our tone is pretty straightforward. But when we write, we have to be careful. We have to be careful because we don't know how something is coming across. For example, if you say to somebody, "Your report confused me," what somebody may perceive is like, "Hey, you're an idiot. You can't write a coherent report." Again, I try to assume everyone who's reading is sensitive. Some people wouldn't matter, but people are sensitive. And sometimes we don't know how our words are coming across. There's a lot of things you could do with tone. A lot of people ask me, they say, "Hey, Jack, you know, people, I'm a supervisor and I'm just trying to do a good job. But people say I'm pretty curt when I send an email. I'm all businesslike. What am I supposed to do?" Well, what you can do is start out your email with a positive tone, a positive message. Then you can be matter of fact. Something simple like, "Hey, I appreciate all your support over the past 3 months." Or again, "I enjoyed working with you on that project where you did a great job." Once you do that, then you say, "Here's what I need you to do going forward. But if you start up by saying, you need to do this, some people are very put off. And most people, we like to be acknowledged for our help, for our good work. Once you get that message that you're acknowledged, you're more willing to do to work harder for the person or get them what they need sooner. So that's one important technique. There are other techniques that with tone, and one is be careful about what I call the hidden insults, also known as passive aggressive communication. Like somebody saying, well, maybe it was me, but I didn't understand your proposal before, or something like that. And so you always have to really be careful about how your words are coming across or saying like something. You know, we need to be more practical in our approach with this client. When you say that to somebody, what you're saying is you're not being practical. You're an idiot, right? So again, that's the way people perceive this. You really have to be as supportive as you can in emails. Be as understand that the other person, in a lot of cases, is probably trying their best. In most cases, again, we very often in business, people annoy us. They don't get us information. Or how about if they're asking you for something that you already gave them? So there are a lot of things, and email is not the place. Email, or whether it's Slack or whatever written communication you use, or text messages, it's not the place to express your frustration to somebody.
Okay? Jack, instead of, you gave us an example earlier, you said your report was confusing to me. Something, yes. I think you mentioned something along those lines. What could we write instead?
I'm glad you asked that, Andrea. Yeah, what do you do instead, right? If the report confused me, I'm being honest. Yeah. What you could say, and it's about really making things just positive going forward. You could say, please clarify these points about your report. Again, I want to help you. I want to help us. Let's say we both have this project to do. Yeah, please clarify these points about your report. Yeah. Make it positive going forward. How can we do better, as opposed to what are you talking about here?
Yeah. Jack, there's another tip that you give in that chapter, which is about writing in such a way that you empathize with the reader, especially when delivering bad news. Mm-hmm. In addition to what you mentioned already, which might be connected, is there anything else to add?
Delivering bad news is never easy. And sometimes, no matter how you say it, somebody's going to be annoyed, whether it's to a client saying, I can't give you what you want, you're not going to get the refund. So all you can do here is just give them the respect and just say it matter-of-factly without saying, oh, I'm terribly sorry. I mean, sometimes people will be more annoyed if you do that. Just try to say it quickly. We regret to inform you that we will not be able to do this or that. And if you can say, we'd be happy to discuss other ways we can help you in different ways. So yeah, don't try to sugarcoat it too much.
Yep. And the most useful section in that chapter for me, Jack, was how to, because it's a challenge that I face often, how to contain our frustration when, for example, we receive, it could be a rude email, yeah. It could be an offensive email. As you said, it doesn't have to be an email. It could be a text message. So for our listeners, to tell us more, how can we go about containing our frustration in those situations?
Well, there's a few ways. One is be sure you know how to use draft. and put it in draft and then come back to it. We all get frustrated. And you need to think about, well, what's your goal here? Is your goal to make the other person feel like they wronged? Or is your goal to maybe educate them on how they can do better next time? And recognize that there are certain things that are not for email. If you're having an issue with another employee or somebody, then maybe you have to take it to HR or say, let's set up a phone call to discuss this. There are certain things. We depend a little bit too much on email and we forget about talking in person. I teach writing, but there are certain times when we're better off talking on the phone. If I have a sensitive issue with somebody, I don't like to go back and forth with emails because it never gets resolved the way it should. I always suggest, hey, let's schedule a time to talk and hash this out.
I'm glad, Jeb, because there are so many parallels between what you're sharing and what we believe in when it comes to public speaking, oral communication, because I also think that we talk about presenting all the time, but I think that we give way too many presentations. I think there are many situations where we should not give a presentation. It would be much better to pick up the phone and make a phone call, or to write an email, for example, a report, a document, or have that conversation. And it's interesting for me to see that you see the same thing from the other, from another perspective.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrea. We've gotten so used to either texting or emailing, and sometimes it's just a waste of time. Even if you're trying to, you want to schedule a meeting and you go back and forth, this and that. If you have a 5-minute conversation, you could resolve it right away. And then you say, one person sent an email confirming we're scheduled for a meeting March 5th, 2 p.m., whatever. So we sometimes depend, now that we have this technology, people use it because it's more comfortable than talking to somebody. It's a substitute, and it shouldn't be. There are times when you do need to talk out loud.
And do you have any tips for something which is also, again, a challenge for me personally, and I guess it's for many people as well, which is how to provide constructive feedback or sometimes criticism, but without making it feel as if it's a personal attack. And in my situation, for example, I have that challenge sometimes, either when working with clients, but even more, I see it for me internally. For example, I think about my assistant who does a fantastic job. Sometimes I think that I do need to offer feedback, but I'm never sure whether I'm doing it well or not. Any thoughts?
Well, what I try to do, and I do this with my students too, is if you can, start out with something that they did, that they have done or are doing well. Start out with that to show them that you are on their side. And that there are things that you do well. You say, thanks again for your excellent job here. I really like how you're doing this, this, and this well. Right? Now, here are some ways I believe that you can improve and achieve better results for you. Always, again, it comes back to the WIFM. Here are some ways you're not just to satisfy me, but here are some ways I believe you can improve and put yourself in a better position to get a promotion or get this client or whatever. So again, it's the strategy is really to start with something positive and then then segue to here's something that's going to ways for you to improve so you can do better at this, this, or this.
Yep. Okay, great. And there's another takeaway from your book, Jack, which is something I need to constantly remind myself of, because it doesn't come naturally to me, which is especially when writing. So when speaking for me, it's different, but when writing, you talk about the idea of speaking one-on-one with your reader, with your audience, mm-hmm. speaking one-on-one. And what comes naturally to me instead is the opposite, like speaking one to many.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about this idea, speaking one-on-one with your readers.
Well, you do it in a lot of situations where you want to show them that, for example, if you're trying to get somebody to improve, or what you do is you put yourself in their shoes and you need to do this. Even if it's a new business proposal or email to a new business prospect, you want to say, you can improve profitability. Your company can improve profitability. You can do this and that. What it's doing, it's part of persuasive communication and tone to a large extent, is you're showing the person who's reading it that you are putting yourself in their shoes and you are trying to experience what they're experiencing. So that's why you want to speak to this, in this case, the second person to that individual. It's like when you write an article, you're writing an article. I write articles for communication publications, PR trade publications, and you write it in the second person. You know, if you want to do this, you can improve your internal communication through these steps. Make the person visualize them going through these steps as opposed to making it generic. Oh, people who do this will improve that. So it's getting somebody to tune into what you're saying because they feel it's affecting them personally.
And that's exactly what I mentioned. For me, what comes naturally is to say something like what people do in this case rather than speaking one-to-one.
Yeah.
So thanks again for another practical piece of advice. And Jack, so in addition to your own resources, your book, which I again recommend, and we have it here again, 10 Steps to Successful Business Writing for our readers, and we are going to include it in the show notes. If you think about what we talked about today, business writing, persuasive writing, do you have any other books that you, it could be a book or it could be any other kind of resource, an article, a video, like we like books. So anything else that you would recommend beyond your own resources?
Well, I got to start with your book. I think your book, Confident Presenter, is excellent. I've gotten a lot of great feedback from my students, and it's aligned with what I say in terms of being practical. I have one book that I'd recommend in terms of, it's a little bit off the topic, but I'll say it anyway. It's called Leading in English, and it's a great book because it talks about, so much of the training in the United States, for example, and perhaps the UK as well, is about having other people kind of accommodate the way we do it in the US or the UK, change your accent or do this. And what we need to realize is that there are more people in the world who work in English who are non-native English speakers. Right? So we need to be able to accommodate them. We need to understand where they're coming from. It's not just them adapting to us. Right? So that's one of the books that really made a big impression to me. It's called Leading in English. It came out about 4 or 5 years ago. I'll leave it at that. There are a lot of good points. Smart Brevity is a very practical book as well.
Yeah, no,
But
thank you. Thank you for mentioning what you've just mentioned, because it resonates with me so much for obvious reasons. Of course, I'm one of those who every day speaks in English, but obviously English is not my first language. I do have my accent. I've been living outside of Italy for way more than 10 years now. I think I will never lose my Italian accent. It's just the way it is. So thanks for mentioning that.
Yeah, well, accents are wonderful. I had just had a student from last semester ask me a couple of weeks ago, what about my accent? And so accents are beautiful. It's not the accent, as long as you are clear, as long as you are clear in what you in how you speak. Of course, and of course, how you write. I think accents are a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And out of curiosity, Jack, if you think about your book, if you could go back to it and change something. And I believe, yeah, this the one I read is already the second edition, but let's say that you had an
Yes.
opportunity to go back to it and change something, maybe for a third edition. Would you change anything? You don't have to, but just out of curiosity.
Would I change anything? I might add something. I think one of the things is that I've been working a lot with communication professionals the past couple of years, with PR practitioners, people in charge of internal communications, and I've come across a lot of people. Yeah, here's what I would put in the book. I've come across a lot of people who are good writers. They're good with they're concise, their words flow, all that. But they're coming to me, or their supervisor sending them to me, because they don't they're not getting to the key point soon enough. In the case of PR people, they're not framing the news properly. They're not writing things from the standpoint of the journalist to whom they're trying to attract attention. They're not capturing that in their leads, or their, if it's a pitch, in their first in the emails, right? They're not looking, not able to look at things enough from the journalist standpoint. Again, it still gets back to the WIFM. In this case, the WIFM is the journalists themselves and the journalist readers. What do they care about? So a lot of people are not doing that well. They're technically good writers, but they're not reflecting the news value up front enough. They're maybe a little too in tune with the assets of their client's product or service. The same goes for internal communication professionals, people who have to write messages for, for the all the employees, and they maybe have to say, well, we have a town hall coming up, or we just have a new product announced. They also some of them aren't really capturing what the reader, in this case, the employees, care about. Employees are busy. They don't sometimes care about these corporate messages. So they're not in tune enough with what the employee cares about, right? New benefit, whatever it is. They're not framing the information so it matters to them. With the what you just mentioned, Andre, with the you, they're not really getting into what that person is experiencing. What do they care about? Okay, yeah, we have a new product. What do I care? Okay, the company's making millions of more dollars. What's in it for me, right? Why should I care? Right?
I get
And a
that.
lot of other cases, we have a new health app, right? Well, what is that going to do for me? Right? So they're not framing the information properly. So that would be a point. That would be something I could add to the book.
Explore, in the book. So looking forward to the third edition then, with that addition. And if anybody would like to connect with you, Jack, where do they find you?
Well, they can look me up on LinkedIn, just Jack Appleman, you'll find me, and come to my company is Successful Business Writing. So it's long but easy to remember. It's successfulbusinesswriting.com, where I offer group workshops, group webinars, one-on-one coaching. Again, it's all about helping people get better results from their writing.
Perfect. We're going to, again, include your links in the show notes. And Jack, as we close, is there anything I didn't ask that you would allow me for me to ask? Any missed important questions? Anything I missed that I should have asked? If we think about, again, business writing, persuasive writing.
Yeah, I think we have covered a lot, and probably the one thing that I want to reiterate is really the right like to speak. Again, that simple principle of that if you are stuck, and we are often stuck, we all experience writer's block at certain points. If you're stuck, think about how you'd say it in a conversation. Give yourself that 30-second test. Somebody puts you on the spot. What's the most important point? And really go through that. And if you think about how you could write it, then you could all how you say it, you can write. What I say is, if you could say it well, then you could write it well.
As you said at the beginning of our conversation, I love that. So you said that sometimes your clients, you say to them, I don't really understand what you're trying to say here. And they say, well, I'm trying to say these, and these. Then just say these, and these. So
that's
I think
right.
we can end with that, which is great. And Jack, thank you very much again for your time today, for sharing your insights. Again, for our listeners, check it out. 10 Steps to Successful Business Writing. Jack, thank you very much again. Let's keep in touch.
Thank you, Andrew. It was a pleasure.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Ideas on Stage podcast, there are many more you might like. So please subscribe, leave us a review, and tell us what you think. You can find many more ideas on business communication at ideasonstage.com or by searching for Ideas on Stage on iTunes, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and goodbye for now.